All three of these cases really are about the violent reassertion of white supremacy, the domination of white people over all others. You have this deputizing of violent enforcement. There's a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today. Kyle Rittenhouse is part of that continuum. It's actually absurd that he should be able to claim self-defense. He went into this situation holding an AR-15.
Welcome to episode 85 of the Refuse Fascism podcast. This podcast is brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of the show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in this country. In today's episode, we're sharing two interviews. First, a conversation with Coco de Haas, an incisive writer, gem of a person, frequent contributor, producer, and guest of the show, co-editor of RefuseFascism.org, and someone I'm proud to call a friend, on her latest piece that's up at RefuseFascism.org, titled The Rittenhouse Trial and Two Sides in Contention, A Beautiful Rising or Rising Fascism. Then we'll share information about strike for choice actions that are being called for on December 1st, on the day the Supreme Court will hear Dobbs versus Whole Women's Health, the case which poses an imminent threat to abortion rights and the possible wholesale gutting of Roe v. Wade. You'll hear from Vara Ramakrishnan, a strike for choice activist, on their plans to make visible support of abortion rights and make visible their refusal to go along with the evisceration of this essential right. But first, let's talk about some developments from this week as they relate to the continued fascist threat. We'll be paying attention to what develops with Steve Bannon, who has now been indicted for contempt of Congress. We do have to note that zero Republican members of the Senate or House that participated in January 6th have been subpoenaed by the January 6th Commission. As the AP reported, a federal appeals court on Thursday temporarily blocked the release of White House records sought by the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. This grants, for now, the request from former President Donald Trump. Oral arguments on this will be heard November 30th, so stay tuned for more. Congressional investigations this week released documents detailing just how forcefully the Trump regime elbowed out the CDC from the initial response to the COVID-19 pandemic. According to Politico, quote, "The emails and transcripts detail how in the early days of 2020, Trump and his allies in the White House blocked media briefings and interviews with CDC officials, attempted to alter public safety guidance normally cleared by the agency, and instructed agency officials to destroy evidence that might be construed as political interference," end quote. It's hard to overestimate the impact of this, except to say that without these actions and others like it by the fascist Trump-Pence regime, there's a chance that this pandemic would simply now just be over. Imagine for a moment if Jared Kushner and Scott Atlas, named in these emails, were actually put on trial for the mass deaths they caused. Instead, we are dealing with a reality where spreading constantly evolving COVID misinformation is a battle cry for the fascist cause. In related news, Michael Flynn spoke this weekend at a stop on the quote-unquote Reawaken America tour, for which he is a prominent part of, a project that brings together Trump loyalists, anti-science conspiracy theorists, so-called doctors, and evangelical leaders to spread the triple plagues of fascism, COVID misinformation, and COVID itself. This horror show has flown under the radar up until this point, but Flynn's statements were so soundbiteable that it finally broke through. Covered by mainstream outlets and trending on Twitter, he said, quote, "If we are going to have one nation under God, which we must, we have to have one religion, one nation under God, and one religion under God," end quote. In response, there is talk about how Trump just uses religion cynically, talk about what constitutes quote-unquote real Christianity, that Flynn isn't a real Christian, speculation that he's not talking about Christianity at all, just Trumpism or Q, and talk about how the Constitution is a secular document. Well, we've spent some time on this podcast getting into the heart of the theocratic element of American fascism with some of the foremost experts on the subject, and I highly recommend people go back and listen to some of those episodes. Here I'll say that there are two sides of this statement that are important. One is that, yes, this fascist movement is to be taken seriously in its push to bring its favored forms of Christianity into the center of American governance and to weaponize that. And they are making real advances even now while they are ostensibly out of power. Just look at abortion rights. So what does that tell you about what they'll do when they retake the legislature and potentially the White House by hook or by crook? They are deeply entrenched in the judiciary and the military, where Flynn came out of, and where his brother still has his hands on the levers of power. And where the broom doesn't sweep, the dust won't simply vanish. This is something newish, but there's also something old going on here, which is that white evangelical theocracy is not simply a religion for these people or even for this country. It is an identity that the most powerful reactionary movements throughout our history have woven deeply into the fabric of this nation. From today's QAnon and Oath Keepers and megachurches, going back to the segregationists of the 50s and 60s, back to the first wave of the Ku Klux Klan, the Confederacy, and even back to the quote-unquote nativists pre-Civil War. In many cases, going back to the first exterminationist settlers. And they see themselves as the rightful heirs of the empire in a moment where the ruling consensus of a sensibly pluralist democracy that has held the country together to one degree or another for 150 years is palpably failing. So this is something that we need to be studying, examining, and strongly repudiating. In my interview with Coco, she brings up the way fascism is advancing in the state level. And to that end, I want to highlight something that happened this week. Virginia elected officials shared their plan to burn books they deem unfit. Their book burning list includes an American Library Association, quote unquote, best book for young adults. And that they did this on the eve of the anniversary of Kristallnacht, a massive pogrom that took place in 1938 across Germany, killing over 90 Jews, burning hundreds of synagogues, destroying Jewish businesses, and arresting 30,000 Jews should not be lost on us. Book burnings, especially of what were deemed sexually explicit or devious books, were a key part in the Nazi campaign. Before the burning of synagogues, there was the burning of books. The first large burning came in the spring of 1933, May 6th. The German Student Union made an organized attack on Dr. Hirschfeld's Institute of Sex Research. Its libraries, its archives of around 20,000 books and journals were publicly hauled out into the street and set aflame. Virginia's book burning plan is one particularly egregious element of a larger campaign to undermine and erase any understanding of how we got here that differs from the standard American mythology. PEN America released a report this week exposing what they are calling educational gag orders that outlines how lawmakers in nearly half of the country this year have tried to muzzle educators in regards to topics that include racism, sexism, and American history. As detailed in the report, from January to September, a total of 54 bills concerning K-12 schools, higher education institutions, and state agencies were introduced. 11 of those bills have become laws in 9 states, including Texas, Tennessee, and Oklahoma. And in sharing this report, they wrote, quote, PEN America intends this report to sound the alarm and recognize these bills for what they are, attempts to legislate constraints on certain depictions or discussions of United States history and society in educational settings, to stigmatize and suppress specific intellectual frameworks, academic arguments, and opinions, and to impose a particular political diktat on numerous forms of public education. Taken together, these efforts amount to a sweeping crusade for content and viewpoint-based state censorship, end quote. We're linking the report in the show notes, and we'll be talking about this more in the next episode. We're continuing to pay special attention to the 3 trials with tremendous stakes. In Charlottesville, the federal civil trial of 24 white supremacist groups and individuals, those who came to Charlottesville in August 2017 and unleashed fascist violence that led to the murder of Heather Heyer. In Brunswick, Georgia, the case against Gregory McMichael, Travis McMichael, and William Bryan, who are on trial for hunting down and murdering Ahmaud Arbery, an unarmed 25-year-old black man who was out on a jog. And in Madison, Wisconsin, the criminal murder trial for Kyle Rittenhouse, who traveled with an AR-15 to a Black Lives Matter protest in Kenosha, where he shot and killed 2 protesters and wounded another. All 3 of these cases concentrate the fascist mobs and threats of violence that are being unleashed to build the fascist movement and consolidate power, and reflect the ways in which there is an assault on the rule of law in this country and the most vicious overt white supremacy that threads it all together. Today's interview focuses on the Rittenhouse trial. In my chat with Coco, I mentioned the article in the New York Times titled, "Menace Enters the Republican Extreme." that details the way in which, quote, threats of violence have become commonplace among a significant part of the party, as historians and those who study democracy warn of a dark shift in American politics, end quote. One example included from just this past week was how Representative Paul Gosar tweeted an anime video depicting him killing Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and swinging swords at President Biden, and how with overt threats of violence, it is now normalized with no censure, let alone condemnation from top GOP members. As Babavakian wrote, the Republicans have become a fascist party, ready to use violence not only against masses of people, but also against its rivals in the ruling class. The quote-unquote norms are coming undone. The question is what will replace them. With that, here's my interview with Coco Das. Welcome, Coco. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Sam. It's good to be here.
It's really good to have you. So anybody who has a heart, and people on the other side too, who are completely without a conscience, have been paying attention to this case, because it is clear to people, in my opinion, on the side of humanity and on the side of fascism, that this is a case with tremendous stakes. And I wanted to take a moment and start with, why did you feel you needed to write something about the Rittenhouse trial? And how do you see that relating to fascism in this country?
I think, like a lot of people, I was getting information about the trial itself, how messed up it was, you know, things about what the judge was allowing or not allowing, the restraints on the prosecution that were not restraints, you know, in the defense of Kyle Rittenhouse got all this freedom and there were so many restraints on the prosecution. And so I was getting sort of bits and pieces, but I think out of some collective conversations and correspondence with the ed board of refusefascism.org, which includes Sansara Taylor, Andy Z, you, me, and Paul Street, it was clear that there was something bigger going on here that wasn't quite getting into the debate and discussion of it. And it really was interesting for me to go back through the timeline and put this really firmly in the context of what was happening in the summer of 2020 and why Kyle Rittenhouse and other members of, you know, militias, armed right-wing fascist militias, went to Kenosha as a response to something that was a really big crisis for this fascist movement, which was that millions of people all around the country and, in fact, all around the world rose up in righteous protest, overwhelmingly nonviolent protest, people from all walks of life, many Black people. And I should say this was in response to the horrific, torturous murder of George Floyd, which was videotaped for people all over the world to see. 9 minutes of knee on his neck. And people righteously rose up in rebellion against this. Trump actually came to power on this. He said the police should be more brutal. There was this context where these millions of people are rising up and the fascist movement, which came to power on the basis of virulent, open white supremacy, aggressive white supremacy, it put that movement on the defensive. It put Trump on the defensive. He had to go hide in his bunker, right? They tried all this stuff, the National Guard, this secret federal force, to bring repression down and stop these protests, and they didn't work. And then the fascist movement had to regroup. I think, in my opinion, this was the biggest crisis that the Trump-Pence regime had encountered, more than impeachment, more than, you know, any of the normal channels that people were saying would be the end of the Trump regime. This was actually, I think, the biggest crisis for them. And then there was a process of regrouping. So Trump doubling down on the white supremacy, doubling down on the like celebration of genocide and slavery in this country. He went to Tulsa, Oklahoma on Juneteenth weekend. And that was very deliberate, that he's going to go and have his lynch mob style, KKK style rally on Juneteenth, the weekend that people celebrate the emancipation of enslaved people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the site of the worst race riot, white supremacist riot in the history of this country, right? He starts there and then he just keeps going from there. July 4th, Mount Rushmore goes on these wild rants about Antifa and Black Lives Matter and his political enemies. And he's whipping up this violent rhetoric, this fascist rhetoric that's really regalvanizing the movement to respond to these protests. And then at the end of the summer, there's the horrible shooting at close range in the back of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And that video also goes viral, also gets a response, and people in Kenosha rise up righteously to protest this wanton violence and shooting down Black and brown people in this country. And another thing I'll say about the Black Lives Matter, the beautiful rising we're referring to in the title, these protests became a sort of a repudiation of not just what happened to George Floyd, but the whole history of white supremacy and the brutality against Black people. It actually opened up a whole debate and change the terms of debate on race in this country so that Confederate statues were coming down. People were really questioning, white people, people of other ethnicities, as well as Black people, really questioning what this country was about. And this was a nightmare for the fascists. So in Kenosha, there's also this rising up, these protests in response to this brutal police shooting, which left Jacob Blake partially paralyzed. And then sort of in the context of what Trump was doing to re-galvanize the movement, these right-wing fascist militias, armed, organized groups of armed fascists were starting to go into these protests and harass, intimidate, and do violence against people. I believe it was in Portland where they were pepper spraying protesters and one of them got shot and became a sort of martyr for the fascist movement. So Kyle Rittenhouse was a 17-year-old, Trump-loving, gun-loving young member of, you know, not an official member, but an admirer, maybe an official member, I don't think we know, but an admirer and follower of this movement. And he goes to Kenosha to police and patrol the protesters. No matter what people say was going on, that's what he went to do.
To protect private property.
To protect private property. And with a AR-15, which he obtained illegally from a friend in Wisconsin. Then there's sort of a direct line from Kyle Rittenhouse, what happened after he killed two men, shot three men. He became sort of a touchstone and a hero for this fascist movement, which really does require this kind of violence in order to consolidate power, in order to control dissent and enforce their agenda. That really is a nightmare for humanity, and that people do need to rise up against, right? They do need to rebel against this. The only way they can actually do that is through this kind of violence. It's a central tenet of fascism that fascist mobs, as well as the state violence, helps to bring the consolidation of the fascist program, which aims to remake all of society and government and to implement a open dictatorship. So the only way they can really do it is through this kind of violence. So he becomes celebrated. And then there is a direct line from Kyle Rittenhouse to January 6th.
You know, the whole thing is, I think it's really important to kind of pull back the lens in a few ways. You know, one is, it makes perfect sense to me that people are outraged as fuck at Schroeder. I think I'm saying his name right. But the judge in this case, like, it makes perfect. I mean, it's outrageous. The shit he's done, including his pretrial decisions regarding jurors, like all of it is grotesque. It makes sense that people's attention is there in the same way that it makes sense that people are furious at the hypocrisy that the media is portraying, that the Rittenhouse is the victim, or Rittenhouse as a caught up teenager who is caught up in the moment, whereas they portray Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown, who were gunned down as criminals. I think it makes sense that people's attention goes there. But I think that it's essential right now, because the stakes are so high, that we pull the lens back and talk about the story that's bigger than the judge, the story that's even bigger than the fascist thug Rittenhouse, into what's at play and where is all of this going and what these cases have to do with this large struggle that's going on in society of whether fascism gets consolidated, regains its total foothold in society, or whether something better can come about. The pattern that we're seeing, to me, makes very clear that whatever sense of normal politics people were hoping was going to return to this case, along with what we're seeing in the Ahmaud Arbery case, the murders of Ahmaud, and what we're seeing in Charlottesville as well, point to me the institutions that people thought could handle this, could help beat back fascism, are ill-equipped to do so. This is a moment where we need to all be paying attention and all be doing the work to not just look in the surface, but dig deeper in terms of why is this happening and what does this represent? And yes, what is my role in all this? Beyond that of a passive consumer of the news, what role do I have?
I really agree. And I think it's really important to understand the importance of two sides in contention. All three of these cases really are about the violent reassertion of white supremacy, the domination of white people over all others. And they can only achieve that through the same kind of violence that was used to enforce Jim Crow, even slavery. That's kind of what they want. They want everybody else to be cowering. But just as they can't actually achieve that without this brutality and violence, I'm speaking for myself here, but you know, this is part of what Refuse Fascism has been organizing for. We're not going to drive this scourge out of our society and out of our government without a massive response from millions of people. It is going to take the kinds of actions that we saw during the Beautiful Rising, millions of people in the streets. It's not going to be done through these normal channels and institutions that the Trump's GOP has shredded. They don't care about these norms and rules. They'll tear all that up. And it will take a movement of people who are willing to step outside of the normal channels and rise up. You know, it really is going to take a beautiful rising of people to repudiate this whole fascist program and drive it out, because I think we're in a process of seeing them reconsolidate. They have state power in many of the state houses. They're advancing, they're having victories in abortion rights, in crushing abortion rights, crushing voting rights. If this trajectory continues, they will win back the White House. They'll win back, you know, federal power. And they'll do it with the utmost revenge. If that is allowed to happen through relying on business as usual and relying on the norms, then it's going to create a future that's really an existential crisis for, you know, not just ourselves in this country, but for humanity as a whole.
I think that the danger that you're pointing to is real and it's ominous. And I think that people a lot of times are looking at what's going on and they're still seeing these as separate, egregious incidents, lacking the kind of analysis that you are bringing into it, that these assaults, there's a common thread here, and this is all part of a fascist movement. I wanted to highlight a section of what you wrote. I think it's how you open your piece, and it's, you write, quote, Kyle Rittenhouse is a fascist youth who joined an armed militia on a self-appointed patrol of a protest for Black lives. What is being fought out in his trial for murder is not self-defense, as he tearfully claims, but the greenlighting of extra legal fascist violence for the right of armed white supremacists to surveil, harass, intimidate, assault, and yes, murder protesters in service of a whole fascist program. The two men whose lives he took, a fact which is not under dispute, were his victims and heroes who were standing up for justice, end quote. And I wanted to kind of bring people's attention to what his defense is fighting for and what the millions of his supporters are fighting for, the kind of world and future that they're going for. And I was hoping that you could speak a little bit more to the connection between the extra legal violence that we saw in Kenosha that's represented in this trial and what we've seen January 6th and onward in the quote unquote Stop the Steal movement.
Paul Street mentions in a piece that's also up on refusefascism.org. And I've heard Jason Stanley also put it this way, that fascism is lawlessness in the name of law and order. And I think you sort of see that concentrated here. But what they're fighting for, what that side is fighting for, is a society where anyone who is a white male is the law. Anyone who is a proponent of this white supremacist mentality is the law. I don't want to actually equate that with being a white male, because his victims were actually white males. But anyone who is, you know, fighting for this fascist program is the law, and everyone else is criminal. And how dare anybody try to resist this domination and natural order of things. So it's actually absurd that he should be able to claim self-defense. He went into this situation holding an AR-15, and the complete degradation of the rule of law, the claim that Kyle Rittenhouse, just by virtue of who he is the law. He's an extension of the law, and everyone else is criminal.
I was thinking how the green lighting that you're speaking, what does that look like? I personally see it in what's going down in Texas, right? Mm-hmm. In many similar ways, it's the mob rule. It is violence. It is violence to prevent a person from getting an abortion. It is violence to punish those who provide care. Those are acts of violence, in my opinion, in the same way that, you know, we're seeing, again, this is my opinion, that the rash of threats and harassment that elected officials across the country have faced post the election that continue to occur and will only heighten as the midterms approach, that kind of rings in the same way as this extra legal violence. I think that there are other ways that you might see this unfolding. And I would love to hear your thoughts on that. And in particular, what is this connection you alluded to earlier between Rittenhouse and January 6th? And I would just add to that, that you had used the word direct line, right? The direct line from Rittenhouse to January 6th. And I think that that's true. And we should talk about it in the same vein. I think that there is, you know, and this is something that to me, this case really illustrates that there's a direct line, as revolutionary leader Baba Begin has said, from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBTQ people, and as well as women, their willful rejection of science in the scientific method, their raw American first jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries. And this was something that Avakian had said in a speech in 2017 and has been laid to bear as very, very accurate. And even without them being in power, I think that what they are harking back to with all the violence that entails is important for all of us to recognize, because I think it does underscore this moment that we're in where society is being ripped apart. And there are two sides at play in the way that you're speaking to in your piece about these two sides in contention. Is it going to be a beautiful rising that Black Lives Matter is all a part of that spirit, or is it going to be rising fascism? So
to go back a little bit, what you see here that's also at play with the Texas law and the mobs of people descending on school boards and sending death threats to election officials and things is that you have this deputizing of violent enforcement. Think of how much they're actually accomplishing with that. It does put a chilling effect on righteous protests. The way that they have actually co-opted the idea of protest, you know, they're protesting mask mandates and the vaccine, life-saving measures. I don't even want to call those protests. So, you know, it does put a chill on protest. It does, as they're hoping, you know, make people think twice about going and opposing them. And this actually, we did see this play out in DC in December when the Proud Boys kept coming back to DC. And many people argued with us that we should not go out there and meet them. You know, and we're not saying meet them in street brawls, but what difference it would have made if in December people had flooded the streets, not fighting for Trump, but saying, no, we refuse to accept a fascist America. What a difference that would have made. Then you have more and more people actually who are willing to step out and do violence for this fascist movement. And Trump really understood how to galvanize that and how to whip people up. And so when I say there's a direct line, that Avakian quote you said was also very crucial. There's a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today. And Kyle Rittenhouse, as part of that continuum, demonstrated to people that you can go and brandish a weapon and kill two people and you can become a hero to this fascist movement and you can be celebrated and feel completely justified in what you've done. So then you've got hundreds of people who feel completely justified through this embracing of the big lie that Trump actually won the election in storming the Capitol violently. It's a siege, you know, six people, I believe, died, six or seven people. And then in the aftermath of that, if you combine that deputizing this like citizen force, which also happened in Nazi Germany, it's a big part of how fascists have consolidated in history. But you couple that with the state power that fascists in this country do have in Texas, in Georgia, in, you know, different parts of the country, where you can further unleash these mobs, but back it up with your state's laws, back it up with the brute force of the police and, you know, National Guard or whatever you have at your disposal, then they are at a tremendous advantage, but they still fear, they are terrified of people rising up like they did in 2020. That is actually the force that they fear most, is the us in our millions who are on the side of humanity.
I was thinking about people listening, and we, as listeners of Refuse Fascism, most of us, if not all of us, I'm sure, are using the F word to describe what's happening, are saying fascism. And many might be like myself, wondering why we continue to be confronted, even with all of the fascist violence that we've been seeing, force individuals and whole institutions that study democracy continuing to not call a spade a spade. You know, I was thinking about the New York Times, and they published, I think it was yesterday, an article by Lisa Lehrer and Asid Herdon, and titled Menace Enters the Republican Mainstream. And it does a tremendous job, in my opinion, at highlighting some of the serious, egregious departures from normal politics, you know, the overt violence. It doesn't actually talk about how white supremacy is at the core of a lot of this violence, and the hatred of women is also at a core of a lot of this violence, but it does do a damning indictment of the GOP and the shift that we have seen. And I wanted to read an excerpt of that very briefly. Quote, from congressional offices to community meeting rooms, threats of violence are becoming commonplace among a significant segment of the Republican Party. 10 months after rioters attacked the United States Capitol on January 6th, and after 4 years of a president who often spoke in violent terms about his adversaries, right-wing Republicans are talking more openly and frequently about the use of force as justifiable in opposition to those who dislodged him from power, end quote. I was just wondering what your thoughts are as to what's with this refusal, this adamant refusal to even name the problem. What's served by that?
Yeah, I mean, I read that article last night and I tweeted, I think there's a word for this. What is it? I find it really frustrating. I don't exactly know. I guess I can guess that when you talk about fascism and it harkens back to what it took actually to defeat Hitler and the fascist powers in World War II, that people don't want to quite confront that something on that scale, or something on the scale of the Civil War, right? Is, you know, that Civil War is kind of pre-fascist, but something like that is happening here, and that we're on that trajectory, and it's going to take tremendous sacrifice to stop it. I think there's also just a complete lack of understanding or a will to even understand what fascism is. Who throws around the word fascism? A lot. It's these anti-mask, anti-vax lunatics who are trying to,
who are wearing Jewish
wearing
stars.
Yellow stars. I mean, it's such a perversion. It's such insanity. And yet people who do a very good exposure of this violent ethos in the GOP will not use the word fascism. It's actually very dangerous. I think it's dangerous. It's damaging. And, you know, as much interesting exposure as that article did, and people are doing around, you know, the anti-democratic GOP, it is much deeper than that. It is a fascist movement. Fascism has defining features. It has a trajectory, and it has a certain way that it's defeated and certain ways that it's not defeated. And I really think all of us who do have this understanding, we have to insist that we do better on this. People do their work. This is not something mysterious that can't be understood. And I think there's also this misconception that calling someone a fascist is just an insult, that there's no substance to it. But Refuse Fascism called Trump a fascist for very good reason. The reasons that we called the Trump-Pence regime fascist have all been borne out to be true, culminating in this January 6th coup attempt. So I think it is a fear that this reality that the world as we know it is being torn asunder, that that's really happening and it's not going to be resolved easily through the election of Biden or, you know, more Democrats in power. And I think that article actually speaks to one reason why that's not the case. Yet it won't consider that what this is concentrating is a very dangerous 21st century American fascism. There's a sort of modulation of, okay, this is the level of concern and terror you should have, but don't go beyond that. Don't take it too far. Because if we say that one party of this democracy has become thoroughly fascist, what does that say about this system and the ability of this system to progress, to become like, you know, a more perfect union? Whatever it is that they are telling you is the goal, the end game, that we're just constantly going to be better and better. What does that say about all that? It throws all of that into question. But I think this is a difficult question. I think it's something everybody listening should really write to us and tell us your thoughts about it. But I think there's something right in what you're saying about there's this tightrope that they're walking. There's this line that they can't cross because it throws into question so much more than just this present moment.
Yeah, so definitely write to us and write to Coco and share your thoughts. You can tweet Coco at Coco_Das and let her know what your thoughts on this question are and your thoughts on her article. Then go and read The Rittenhouse Trial and Two Sides in Contention, A Beautiful Rising or Rising Fascism. You can get that in the show notes or on the homepage at refusefascism.org. I want to thank Coco again for joining us and spending some time digging into all of this with us. And do you have anything else you wanted to say, Coco?
No, it's always good to talk to you and try to hash some of these things out. It's going to take conversations like this on a grand scale to really confront and understand what's going on.
You can check out the article by Paul Street that Coco mentions, Reflections from Kenosha, up at refusefascism.org. It's really, really worth reading. In it, he clearly outlines the stakes involved in the case. He writes, quote, "A not guilty verdict will amount to a declaration of state-sanctioned fascist thug war on human rights and social justice advocates from coast to coast. Kyle Rittenhouse must not be permitted to get away with fascist murder," end quote. A link to his article will be in the show notes, but also you can go to refusefascism.org and get it there right at the homepage. Here is Vara Ramakrishnan with Strike for Choice on their plans to take action on December 1st and how you can join. Have a listen.
So today I am talking with Vara Ramakrishnan to discuss action that people can take in response to the case that involves Mississippi, the case that we've been talking a lot about on the show, Dobbs versus Whole Women's Health. And it's going to be heard in front of the Supreme Court, oral arguments on December 1st. And a lot of people have been thinking that we just need to prepare for the worst, that there's nothing we can do. Well, I'm glad to be talking to someone who does not think that now is the time for capitulation or compromise, but action. To do that, I'm glad that I get to chat with Vara. She is an activist with Vigil for Democracy and participating in Strike for Choice actions on December 1st. Welcome, Vara Ramakrishnan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Vara, let's talk about the big question. Why should people take action on December 1st? What's going on here? What's motivating you to protest?
If we don't do anything, then nothing happens that we care about. So if nobody acts on this, we can assume that the Supreme Court is going to act according to its leanings. And that's pretty obvious. We have a 6-3 fundamentalist court, and they have all been pretty clear about their intentions, that they're not going to treat Roe as established law, and they will overturn it. So that's the likely outcome by next June. So to be clear, the oral arguments are on December 1st. They usually take a while to deliberate on it. They're expected to issue a ruling on this case next summer. So by summer of 2022, we can expect that abortion will be pretty much illegal in America. So that will be the case if we allow things to proceed. When I think about this nation going backwards in that way, having abortion be illegal, it almost makes me physically sick. I don't think I want to live in a country that pushes more than half its population back into the dark ages. Medicine has evolved, and there's no reason why people with uteruses should not have access to that medical care. The other thing is that if this law changes in America, the rest of the world suffers. People everywhere will be affected by this because the aid that America gives to other countries will change drastically. They will put all kinds of restrictions on medical care where abortion might also be provided right now. And then in countries where there's already a fascist authoritarian regime trying to consolidate power, they will look to America, they will cite America's laws to then worsen their own. So this is not the same as Mexico or some other smaller economy that's not widely understood as the leader of the free world changing its laws. This is the US changing its laws. It's very serious for everybody. The reason there's still hope is because if you look at the history of the Supreme Court, yes, they've made jarring, ugly rulings that go against civil rights and against humanity. But in cases where publicity has been high, they have almost always ruled with public opinion. So right now, the justices may be feeling arrogant, maybe feeling like they can get away with it. But if there's mass unrest on December 1st and beyond, we can win and women can have their abortion rights. People who might be suffering miscarriages or other medical emergencies during a pregnancy don't have to be sentenced to death by scaring their own doctors. So that's the hope. Now, in terms of protest, I believe there has been a hijacking of the public understanding of what protest is in America. And I watched it unfold with great dismay. I tried very hard in 2016 to get involved, to try and change what happened then. But I didn't have a platform. I was one voice. And the powers that existed at that time really wanted it to go the way it did, which is you get a huge mass of people together. You pick a date that's a convenient Saturday. You pick a location that's an empty main street where there's really no businesses functioning. And you march through there saying, we will be heard. Well, you're not heard. Nobody's hearing you. You can say that and feel good. When there's an audience, you can say anything and feel good about it. But it has no impact. And that is what has been spoon-fed to America. So the fact is, every suburban citizen who thinks they've protested has actually wasted their time. They might have had a good time. They might have made some friendships. They might have made buddies who they can talk politics with, because sometimes it's lonely when you understand politics. And so maybe you can't talk to your family. You met somebody at a Saturday march. That's your people now. That's good. But again, we are over 5 years into autocracy, and those Saturday marches are not going to do anything. Looking back to my childhood, when I actually didn't know that I was absorbing the politics of what was going on, and now I think back about it often, there's a few things. One is that pretty often, the entire city would be at a standstill. You couldn't get to school or anywhere that you wanted to go. And so you didn't go. It used to be called Bund, which is closed in Hindi. And it didn't matter if Hindi was not the language spoken where you were. You knew what a Bund was, which is, hey, it's like a snow day. No school. You know, if you're a kid, nothing happens. You better hope that you have enough food and whatever supplies, because doctor, you know, there's no buses running. There's no grocery stores, nothing. It's just a still city. And this would happen as a show of power to kind of win concessions from the government. This doesn't happen here at all. We need that. Because the thing is, even one day is a massive shock to any functioning, well-run economy, which America is right now. So if we can bring things to a standstill, or at least to a lower mode of functioning on one day, then that shows, that exposes the power that people have, right? So that's what the point is of a strike. The other thing that I want to point out is we want to show our power. And so we should study how people who are powerless, who are trying to claim back power, we can learn from those things and use those things in nonviolent, peaceful ways. And an important thing they do is multiple simultaneous actions. To bring a city to its knees, you want to kind of jam 3 locations, 5 locations, 7 locations at a time. And there's a conversation that somebody had with the police chief of a major city, I think it was LA, but I'm not certain, asking, you know, what the nightmare scenario is. What that chief had said is, yeah, you know, if you say 10,000 people, you know, at City Hall, it's something we have to worry about and deal with. But we know how to deal with that. But instead, if you have 1,000 people at 10 different locations across the city, then I'm really terrified. I don't know how to deal with that. I don't know what will go wrong. And I have to be on edge, and it probably won't be okay. when we organize protests, even the Saturday things, it always, oh, everybody show up at this one location, march to another location, done. And going back to what I said about 2016, what I wanted, what I begged and hoped that people would do is to say, let's put out a call and recruit medics and recruit food trucks. And let's keep the porta potties for a week or 10 days. Tell the women not to go home, right? After the Women's March. If we had done that, it would have been a different regime, even if Trump had managed to stay in power. Because then it shows that you're not willing to be governed in the way that they want you to be. It shows that you're not manageable. Part of doing an action is being visible. Because if you did this and nobody knows that you did it, then there's no sense of community. There's no press from it. There's no way to build to the next one.
That's what I was going to ask you about, because when a lot of people hear about the word strike, people think I stay at home and I just don't go to work and that I've done my job. Right. And I think that one of the things that I really unite with in terms of what you're saying is creating a situation where it is clear to the whole world that we aren't going to let pregnant people be slammed backwards and either condemned in some situations to death by not having access to an abortion, or at least having their future foreclosed and being reduced to an incubator. And I think that having a situation where it is made crystal clear by people that they're not going to go back, that we are going to fight with everything we have for abortion rights to be protected, defended, I think would be tremendous. And it is very refreshing to hear what you're saying about protest that isn't domesticated, protest that isn't done on the terms that are convenient for those who rule. And I think that's really important. And I think with something that has such high stakes for so many people, the fact that this alarm is not being sound is devastating.
Right.
And so I think it would make a profound difference if there was visible resistance. And so if you could speak to a little bit about how do we make that visible?
So there's many ways from small to big. So the key is now we have a date that is a Wednesday. It's a weekday. It's actually also, it's a day when Congress is in session. Both the Senate and the House is in session. Everybody is going to be in D.C. So since the Supreme Court is in D.C., the justices all live around there. There's actions that are being planned in D.C. kind of escalating towards December 1st. That's one thing. But the strike itself, what we're asking people to do is to commit early, to commit now. We are 3 weeks at this point. To say that I commit to strike, and to say what it's about, and to post about it, to talk about it, so that your immediate circle, there's nobody around you who is unaware of what your plan is in 3 weeks or as you count down. So that's part of it, to commit to saying, I will not go to work, or I will not do my unpaid labor, you know, I'm not going to fix lunches or whatever it is that you do, just that one day you're going to check out of that. If you're going to school, you're going to ask for a day off, or you're going to tell your professor that, listen, I need to walk out. If you shop and you spend, you're going to say, you know, I'm not going to spend any money that day, and you're going to declare that. And last option is a hunger strike, to say, I'm going to skip lunch or breakfast and lunch, just one day. Everybody understands that it's not easy to skip a meal. And if you're going to make a point of doing that, that matters. Now, again, all of this, if on the day off, if you're able to not just stay home, but to go to your town square with a simple sign, and we're creating materials that people can print out or get inspiration from and then make their own. So strikeforchoice.org is going to be the center where all of this will be available. Right now, it's got a simple sign-up form that talks about everything you can do, but all the resources you need, all of that will be available on the site. So that's the strike portion of it. The other thing is that we do want to combine it with a direct action, and there's already a lot of excitement and engagement over that. There are two companies that have kind of emerged as villains in this story from Texas that everybody knows about. So one is Whole Foods, that's based in Texas, headquartered in Texas in Austin, and has almost 500 stores, mostly in the US, a handful in Canada, and some in the UK. The largest number of their stores is in Texas, and they have been silent about the Texas vigilante law. So going to your local Whole Foods store with just a small number of people, 5 to 10 people, just your friends who care about this issue, in costume, maybe just green t-shirts like the South American women did, maybe in red cloaks if that appeals to you, maybe in t-shirts with your messages about abortion, and raging grannies are going to go in their aprons and their hangers and whatever messages they want to take. So treat it like a costume party and show up at your Whole Foods store, leave without spending anything. We're creating signs saying, you know, we are your spenders, how come you don't care about us? Because the fact is, people with uteruses do the vast majority of grocery shopping. everywhere. And it's shameful that they've not bothered to acknowledge that there are no abortion rights in Texas right now. It's virtually, it's gone. And it's been that way for 2 months. It'll be 3 months by the time this comes around, right? September, October, November, the law has completely chilled all abortion rights. The other villain is AT&T, which has been the single largest funder of these Texas legislators who dreamt up and created this law, which has also then inspired the other copycat laws that are spreading across the southern states. AT&T, there's over 5,000 stores across America. If you're in a rural area and you're a person who's concerned about abortion rights, you're probably a couple hours from a Whole Foods, but there's going to be an AT&T store at your rural main street. So that's an option. And again, those two locations, we're simply saying noon. And we want people to think about this not as an organizing event. You don't have to be an activist. You don't have to be an organizer. Almost everybody knows how to throw a dinner party. They know how to do a costume party. They know how to organize a girls' night out. You don't have to treat this like a rally. It's not. It's something you're asking your folks, saying, hey, do you care about this? Because I care about it. Will you go with me? Commit to it. When somebody sends you an e-bite, you don't say maybe. You say yes or no, right? Maybe is rude when somebody invites you to a dinner party. But maybe it's okay to rally, and most people maybe to rallies, and they don't go because they don't know they'll be missed. Well, you're going to be missed if you don't show up to walk through Whole Foods with your, you know, four friends with signs, creating a spectacle there, leaving a flyer with the manager who shows up saying, hey, what are you doing here? This is what we're doing. Give them a little flyer, let it be known. Now, wouldn't it be amazing if we had a group of folks going to every Whole Foods store in the country on December 1st at lunchtime? Even if you're not striking, if you just go through at lunchtime and send that message, that's going to be heard. That's a story that the media will want to run. And think about it. It's going to take, what, 2,500 people? That's nothing. That's one rally in one town. We just have to have it spread out across the country. That's kind of what we're hoping. Now, some folks want to do it at a different time. They want to do it after school. So they might be doing 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. They may want to go to the federal courthouse. Whatever has meaning to you on that day, if you can be in a public place, if you can be in an outfit or with signs or banners that make a spectacle, that make it clear what's going on that day in the Supreme Court, where those six theocrats are deciding all our fates, then that matters.
Well, I want to underscore that people need to not accept in advance the shredding of the rule of law, mm-hmm. the demolition of bodily autonomy, and the enslavement of women, and the absolute nightmare that could come to be if people don't wake up and take action. People really need to sit with and confront what it means when abortion is not legal. And then people need to act and not start planning for what life is going to be like after Roe. Excuse my language, fuck that. It matters that it's safe. It matters that it's legal. And it matters that it's accessible, all three of them.
Yes.
And so I encourage people to check out Strike for Choice, commit to take visible action on December 1st. I agree with Vara. It is an action that anybody can take. There's no special activist training that you need. Go out, make some noise, be visible. Abortion on demand and without apology. And be sure to check the show notes for how to connect with Strike for Choice and Vigil for Democracy on social media, because my feeling is that we're going to need to project all the beautiful actions that people take on December 1st as part of amplifying and continuing that resistance. Vara, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your perspective. Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. I want to hear from you, share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics, or guests, or lend a skill. Tweet me at Sam B. Goldman, or you can drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@refusefascism.org, or leave a voicemail by calling 917-426-7582. You can also record a voice message by going to anchor.fm/refuse-fascism and clicking the button there. You might even hear yourself on a future episode. Want to support the show? It's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And follow, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Want to help the show reach more listeners? Donate to help us place podcast ads. Give at refusefascism.org or Venmo refuse-fascism. Thanks to Lena Thorne, Richie Marini, and Mark Tinkleman for helping produce this episode.
Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode, so be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox each week. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.